Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, July 3rd, 2017. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape, not steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal, nor are we in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. But instead, well, we're sort of there. I mean, I don't know. I don't want to be too... It's confusing, folks, because it's July 3rd, and in lieu of a live show today, we have a pre-recorded interview that I did the interview, you know, in our studio, but I forgot to do an intro, and I did that where I am right now. So everything's really confusing. But on the program today, Mary Otto, author of Teeth, The Story of Beauty, Inequality, and the Struggle for Oral Health in America. I'm particularly interested in this as a facet of healthcare, which seems completely divorced from the idea of healthcare, and also the history of the development of what we know as, dentistry, I guess, in this country, and oral health. I was particularly interested in this because there was, it was not too long ago. Well, I guess maybe now it was, but I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years ago when I was in between jobs, I cracked my tooth. And I remember just like, this is going to cost $800, and how demoralizing. There's something about teeth. When your teeth break, I mean, in addition to that being really expensive, there's just something that is particularly demoralizing, as opposed to if I had, I don't know, to have some medical procedure. Well, I mean, even my articulating as a medical procedure as opposed to the dental work shows that distinction. But for some reason, maybe because it used to be barbers that would perform dentistry, our system does not take oral health and dental health seriously, and sometimes that's fatal. But we will discuss that with Mary Otto. Also, I should tell you, if you're a member, Matt went on some type of like, I wouldn't even know how to articulate, or I wouldn't know how to categorize this. But you know, the type of binge that he goes on. Well, let's face it. I mean, Matt probably, I don't want to color any future employers of Matt's, but let's face it. He probably sits down with a bong. I don't know this for a fact. I'm speculating. He probably sits down with a bong and gets super high and then goes through the archives and finds stuff that he finds interesting. And frankly, it seems to work. So I encourage it. And for members, he's got a deep archive of the Majority Report, which doesn't even include me. That's how deep it is. It's just Janine talking with the great Lewis Lapham and a guy named David. Is it David Loy Johnson? I wonder if that's David K. Johnson. I don't know, but I guess you'll hear it on a 2005 essay collections, What Do We Know About the Left? And he said he listened through And this is the text he sent me. P, relevant and interesting, given current conversation. And this is from January 05. I don't know what P means, but it's possible. It's possible he was out of his mind when he wrote this text. So it's, I don't know, it's sort of indecipherable. But nevertheless, members are going to get that deep archive show. And if you want to be a member, it's not that hard, folks. First, all you have to do is go over to Matt's apartment and pay him in bags of, or I guess he takes like tea and also oils, tinctures. You just have to give Matt a lot. No, wait, that's not it. You go to jointhemajorityreport.com. Yes, jointhemajorityreport.com. That's where you can become a member and have access to these shows. And you're like, oh, yeah, but I already missed it, so what's the point? Folks, you get the archives. You get the archives, searchable archives on the app. And when we get our new website up, it's going to be even more searchable. So become a member today. Go to jointhemajorityreport.com. And you will have access to this and so much more. Plus, you'll support the free show. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And if you buy your crap from Amazon or Jet.com, of course, go to our link, our set of links at majorityreportkickback.com. You click through those links, we get a kickback. That's why we call it majorityreportkickback.com. We're just not sophisticated enough to come up with some clever name for that would imply we get a kickback. We just go full on hammer, nail. Let's, you know, who are we kidding? Also, tomorrow is July 4th. I want to wish you a happy Independence Day, which happens to coincide this year with, you know, the president being, you know, basically like a huge firebomb on anything that was good about our country. Never mind the deficits that we already have, you know, consider about our country. We're not a perfect country, obviously, have some serious problems. But he took even the good stuff. Seems to have lit that on fire. I'm not going to get into the tweet with where he put the face of where he put CNN over the face. I actually, if anybody has the ability to switch out that CNN, that clip of him wrestling, and switch out the CNN with the words, our healthcare system, you'll get a retweet from me and from the Majority Report, which may not mean much to you, but if it does, we'll put it on our Facebook page, too. Hey, and if you're a member, tomorrow you'll get a show. If you're not a member, just a barbecue for you. Sorry. Tomorrow, Zach and I'm putting in quotes, Seth Galifianakis show up on the deep archive of the Majority Report back in April of 05. And Seth, in quotations, Galifianakis, Zach's, in quotations, brother, was a Bush-voting football coach from North Carolina. I remember that. That was funny. All right. So enjoy this show. We will be back live on Wednesday. And by we, I mean me and all of us. So have a great 4th. I don't know what to tell you, folks. Dark times. But here you can hear about how we got here, at least in terms of our teeth. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone is pleasure to welcome to the program Mary Otto. She is a Washington, D.C.-based freelance writer and the oral health topic leader for the Association of Healthcare Journalists and the author of Teeth, the Story of Beauty, Inequality, and the Struggle for Oral Health in America. Mary, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you. Thank you so much.
So, Mary, you start your book with the story of a 12-year-old child, DeMonte Driver, I believe, And I remember this story from 2007. I was actually on radio at that time. And I remember hearing this story, and it's heartbreaking. And it tell us the story and why you started the book off that way.
Well, it was a story that I couldn't forget. Like you, I was in Washington. I'm still in Washington, 2007. And I was at the Washington Post covering social issues on the Metro desk. And I found myself at the bedside of this boy who turned out to be dying of complications from just untreated tooth decay. He had an abscessed tooth. And doctors told his mother that bacteria from this abscessed tooth had spread to his brain. So he was at Children's Hospital. He spent 6 weeks at Children's in another hospital, actually, where he died. Got $250,000 worth of care, a couple of brain surgeries. It wasn't enough to save him. And he was a Medicaid. His mother had actually been looking for care for his younger brother when Diamante got in sick and got into so much trouble. But Medicaid children have a hard time getting care. Fewer than half receive routine dental care, and fewer than half of dentists accept Medicaid. So there's always kind of a shortage of care for these children. And writing about Diamante's death ended up asking more and more questions about how the system worked and where it fell short. And I've continued to cover this issue.
And so, okay, so, I mean, how common is the basically dental, I guess, dental issues going untreated in this country? I mean, I imagine, I don't know if you know any statistics on how many people end up dying because of a lack of dental care, but surely there must be other implications as well to the...
Sure.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, you know, in the old days, before antibiotics, deaths like Diamante's were actually very, very common, and thankfully they're much rarer now. But studies have tried to find out the answer to that question. One found that about 100 people died of in emergency rooms from dental problems in the three recession years of 2008 through 2010. Another study looked at hospitalizations for dental abscesses like Diamante had, and it found 66 deaths in a decade. Who knew they caught all of them? You know, it's always hard to know.
Right.
But the truth is, roughly a million people a year go to emergency rooms with non-traumatic dental problems, like toothaches. And these problems cost the system $1 billion a year. Most of the people don't get the, you know, care they need for their underlying dental problems at the emergency room. They get a prescription for an antibiotic and a painkiller, told to go see their dentist. But many of them don't have, you know, a dental home, as it's called, a regular dentist. Roughly a third of Americans experience significant barriers in just getting routine care. So that's, you know, over 100 million people.
So there's a million people who go to the ER every year. And having just gotten, I think I spoke about this on the program the other day, a bill from having gone to the emergency room with essentially nothing. It was something like $1,400 just to walk in the door, never mind the tests I got. So we're talking a tremendous amount of expense.
Yeah.
And you also write that the number of people going to the ER doubled between the year 2000 and 2010. What was that a function of?
Well, some of it was law benefits, the financial difficulties of that the country was going through in those years, shortage of dental coverage, economic hardship. You know, people people end up going to the emergency room because the door always opens. You know, you don't have to have any money in your pocket or any kind of identification. You know, they're required to stabilize anyone who comes in. And, you know, if they can't treat a dental infection, at least dispense medicine for pain and infection. But it's just the worst, most expensive way of handling these problems.
Well, let's talk about, I mean, let's start with, and you cover obviously the history of both the development of dental care and also the history of, I guess, insuring for that care. Let's start with the idea that dental care, and let's go back historically to sort of find the origins of this. Dental care in this country, I think as most people know, seems completely divorced from healthcare, broadly speaking. I mean, it's almost, I mean, I would say that even to a certain extent, mental health is more closely aligned with the healthcare system, it seems to me, both the delivery, the practice, the associations, then dental. Is that a fair assessment?
It might be, as we're growing awareness of how mental health affects overall health, has probably contributed to more integration. I mean, and I think on some level, an awareness of how oral health affects overall health might be kind of leading us that way too. In addition, there's this kind of growing, political understanding that oral health is important and should be included in our healthcare system. But you're right. It's the history of this goes back, I found out, to 1840. When the first dental college in the world was established in Baltimore, and there's a kind of creation story of the profession of dentistry in that story of the school. Apparently, these two self-trained dentists, in those days dentists were considered tradespeople, they learned their skills, their manual skills, from more experienced practitioners, and they kind of went out and called themselves dentists and mostly extracted teeth.
But were they working at barbers? Was at that point, like, was everything you do, like a barber shop, was just sort of like one stop hair and teeth and not
in the old
health?
Days? Yeah, okay. I mean there were, yeah, the barber surgeons, you know, from the Middle Ages. They did all kinds of very personal services, like tonsuring, you know, your cutting your hair, trimming your beard, dental extractions. They did cupping and leeching and other kinds of things, you know, considered skills that took a certain amount of dexterity and practice to do. And this, it's went through the Middle Ages that way, and there was kind of a preceptorship system where, you know, the more experienced practitioner taught the newcomer to do these things.
But how did medicine as we define it without dental care, how did that sort of like trail off, or how did that was there a time where they were more integrated and they separated, or what?
Well, this moment of clarity came when these two dentists in Baltimore in 1840 went to the medical school at the University of Maryland and asked the physicians if they would consider adding, like, formal dental training to the course of medical school that they had. And the physicians, as the story goes, said that the subject of dentistry was of no interest to them. So these two dentists went off and started the first dental college in the world across town in Baltimore, and a whole separate educational system and professional system grew up around that first school. You know, other dental colleges opened. The physicians and the dentists were trained separately. The dentists had their own peer-reviewed, you know, magazine or journal and their own dental society, and they went their separate ways. And over the years, critics of the system have said we need to integrate oral health back into the healthcare system, but there's been resistance on the part of dental groups.
So wait, the resistance
the way it is.
Okay, so we have what you write about as the historic rebuff in 1840. And then we carry forward. And then in the 1920s, there's another push to do this. At that point, like who are the forces that are pushing back? Is it the medical industry or is it the dental industry at that point? And why? What were the what was the rationale behind pushing it back?
You mentioned the 1920s. There was. At that point, there was this biological chemist named William Guy's. He was kind of a prophet from Columbia University. He visited every dental school in the United States and Canada, and he called for dentistry to be considered an essential part of the healthcare system. He said, dentistry can no longer be accepted as tooth technology, as mere tooth technology. But organized dentistry, by that time, was fighting to keep dental schools separate and defending the professional autonomy of private practitioners. I mean, more recently, Surgeon General David Satcher, back in 2000, in his really landmark report, Oral Health in America, talked about the necessity of integrating dental care into the healthcare system and providing, you know, building a system that can reach all Americans. But dentistry's been somewhat an insular profession. Is a based on private practice. Dentists, you know, have their own practices and kind of defend their right to accept the patients they want to treat and serve the communities they decide to serve. And it's a hard thing to change.
I mean, when we go back to the 1920s and then through the years, I mean, has that been, I mean, I don't want to, look, I know some great dentists. I know some dentists personally, and I've had some wonderful dentists. There is a sense among some, I don't know why I'm being so sensitive about this, but there is a sense among some that sometimes dentists are looking for innovative products to create. To generate revenue for themselves. And so let me ask you, has the hesitance been, at least in terms of, in some way, becoming more associated with medicine, has the roadblocks been on the sort of more medicine side? And I shouldn't even say medicine because that's bias in itself, but I guess what we traditionally consider of healthcare, has it been on that side of the equation? Has it been on the dental side of the equation? And to the extent that it's been on either one, is the idea, at least from the dental side, like we don't want the possible constraints or oversight that might come with being part of the broader healthcare system?
Well, I know in my research I found there were a number of critical moments when organized dentistries opposed government efforts to integrate and dental care into a larger national kind of healthcare system, and it's defended the private practice system and its control over the marketplace for dental service. When they were talking about, the years between the two world wars, when there was discussion by President Roosevelt to establish a national healthcare system, dentists and physicians actually together to fight nationalization. And the editors of the Journal of the American Dental Association wrote that state dentistry is wrong in principle and it would be disastrous in practice, and considered the idea of called it a monster of exploitation of the dental profession. And when they were drafting soldiers for World War II, many tens of thousands of young men were deemed dental cripples and unfit for service due to bad oral health. They just lacked care. So after the war, the lawmakers again kind of took up this need to expand care and look at, you know, broader ways of getting care, physical, dental care to the population. Again, a delegation from the American Dental Association testified against the practicality of this plan. They said, you know, there weren't enough dentists to meet all the needs. But at the same time, the dental leaders fought against the efforts to respond to the need by training other kinds of dental providers, hygienists with expanded skills to meet the need. And even in the years leading up to the Affordable Care Act, organized dentistry, they opposed provisions that would require providers to participate in, you know, dictate private market fees or anything that would lead to a government-run health care system. I mean, dentists have sort of existed in a sort of separate world for you know, generations now, and it's a hard thing to change or to address in some ways.
And is it basically just these trade organization trying to protect the revenue in that industry and to protect, I mean, to have a diminished supply so that they can maintain what they charge? I mean, that's what it sounds like to me, broadly speaking. I'm not saying any particular dentist, but as a profession, it seems like almost the dental profession does not necessarily perceive itself as in the way that, let's say, you do in terms of like how much, you know, I mean, if I perceive healthcare as a right, and I accept that, and I sort of, you get the sense that the medical profession, even though obviously they don't want to diminish their payments, perceives that they should be offering their services to as much of a wide of a group of possible. It's almost as if the Dental Association, I'm not saying the ADA necessarily in and of itself, but as an industry, does not necessarily share that notion. Like they don't almost take the need for their services as seriously as maybe people who need their services.
Well, that's an interesting point. You know, most dental care in this country is provided through the private practice system. Dentists are, you know, healthcare providers, but they also consider themselves small business people. You know, they invest in their education, they, you know, rent an office space, they hire staff, and they choose often to set up their practices in more affluent metropolitan areas that'll give them hopefully a good return on their investment in their business. And their perspective as private practitioners and small business people are very, very different from the kind of public health perspective that looks at a population and tries to figure out a way of reaching everyone in that population with a certain kind of service. Mm-hmm. Just two different worldviews, and it comes very clear to you when you think about the fact that, you know, roughly a third of Americans just experience significant barriers getting access to that private practice system that provides most of the care, because they either lack the money, you know, to pay for the services, or they don't have the right kind of insurance, or they live in a rural or less affluent area where there just may not be enough dentists or any dentists at all. So it's a, you know, we're depending on this private practice system to get care, dental care to our country, and yet there are places where it's not reaching everyone.
Has the lack of a sort of like insurance solution for dental care and dental health, oral health, has that tracked along the same sort of trajectory as, you know, as the sort of the relationship between dental care and general health care?
Well, dental insurance has always been kind of considered a fringe benefit in some important ways and some difficult ways, too. I mean, we were talking a few minutes ago about the 1960s. Medicare didn't end up having any dental benefits. And now it covers over 50 million Americans, and many of them remain dentally uninsured, you know, because they're elderly, they may be living on fixed income, and Medicare doesn't include routine dental coverage, and they don't go out and buy it. So they suffer the consequences. Medicaid, you know, the federal program that serves, you know, over 70 million poor Americans, entitles poor children to care, although, as we said before, they don't always receive it. Medicaid dental benefits for adults are considered optional, you know, so they vary from state to state. They're often among the first things that get cut in times of fiscal, you know, hardship, just mm-hmm. when people need them the most. The Affordable Care Act didn't fully address this problem either, although dental benefits for children are required to be sold on the insurance exchanges that were set up, you know, by the ACA, and a number of, you know, millions of Americans have received dental benefits through Medicaid expansion
mm-hmm.
over the years, but they're still separate and different. They were created in response to demand from actually labor leaders back in the 1980s who wanted to get dental benefits, especially for their children. And they've kind of evolved from what was then a very innovative model of a capitated group practice kind of model that was created by a dentist named Max Shane in California, and to more, you know, to a dental benefit that it doesn't cover everything, but it's better to have dental benefits than not have them when
right.
you're trying to get access to the system and to get routine preventive care and restorations and things like that. People with dental insurance or dental benefits certainly fare better, you know, statistically speaking, than people who don't have any kind of coverage.
Let's talk just briefly, and I, before we get to, you know, potential solutions, how much of, because you write in the book about the sort of the social implications of dental care. I mean, it's the subtitle of your book is the story of beauty inequality and oral health. I mean, where does beauty and inequality? I mean, obviously, inequality comes in this because it is an expensive service. It is one that is not covered by insurance, not covered as well by public social insurance. But the implications of dental work as sort of like a status symbol and as a beauty concept, and just the idea of the social six. I mean, where is this also? Is dental care, it perceived as a status symbol, is this an American phenomenon? Because, you know, obviously there's been like sort of long-standing jokes about, you know, British teeth, particularly, you know, maybe, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago. But, I mean, is this an American phenomenon, or what's behind that?
Well, actually, there is this American smile or Hollywood smile that is seen as a status symbol around the world. And you mentioned the social six, you know, those are the top front six teeth that people are, you know, you see most clearly when people smile. And having a set of veneers, you know, to cover those teeth to make them look perfect is something that is a procedure that's sought after, you know, even in developing countries now, because people want their teeth to look like, you know, bright white Hollywood teeth. And it's maybe a little bit ironic, but the Hollywood smile got its start in Depression era Hollywood, when the actors didn't really have what we would consider Hollywood smiles today. Films were pretty new, especially talky films. But this Hollywood dentist named Charles Pincus went to the movies and saw some of the actors had crooked or imperfect teeth, and he invented what he called Hollywood veneers. And many of the stars came to him for these snap-on appliances to make their teeth look perfect. Even Shirley Temple, you know, wore them. So we didn't see her lose her baby teeth. But the cosmetic dental boom really took off in the 1980s with the invention of a lot more sophisticated kinds of veneers and other products, and the medical credit cards that came, you know, into their own in the 1990s helped people pay for these elective dental procedures and other kinds of elective procedures, you know, on credit. So we still have this phenomenon, you know, cosmetic dental boom that's going on. But on the other hand, you know, there are many people who lack routine care.
Right.
The American Dental Association did a survey, or had a survey done in 2015, that concluded one out of three low-income Americans avoid smiling. So, you know, at the same time we have this, we place our value on perfect smiles, there are many people who are disfigured and depersonalized by poor oral health, and themselves locked out of job opportunities and social opportunities, and kind of condemned to, you know, struggle.
Well, when
you,
I guess when you see, you know, the dental industry to have such an opportunity where the cosmetic and the oral health are so deeply intertwined in some way, that and it being so much more lucrative to do the cosmetic, right? I mean, like, you know, like I'm trying to, my dentist is trying to talk to me about Invisalign, you know, braces right now that I sort of need, but it would be good, that type of thing. And it's like the cost of a used car. I mean, it's, you know, and as far as I can tell, there's not a whole lot of time that has to be spent with me. And, you know, it just seems like there's a lot of money there in that industry. So what is the solution? I mean, you mentioned the idea of like almost the equivalent of like paradentists, you know, a hygienist. What else is the solution?
Well, the system we have today does incentivize, you know, the high-end elective procedures and even the, you know, high-end restorative procedures. But if we look at it from a public health perspective, disease prevention is very, very important. I mean, the need for restorations is lower when disease is prevented. I mean, tooth decay is a chronic, you know, disease. It's the most prevalent disease of American children and adults. And it can be prevented with, you know, routine, like fluoride treatments for small children, oral health education, you know, so parents are more, you know, able to sort of protect their children from all this, you know, junk food that's marketed so aggressively. Sealants on the newly, you know, emerged molars of children in school. And there are efforts to, as you said, adapt the dental workforce to get more of this care out to where the patients are, especially children. In some states, dental hygienists are now going out to schools to provide these simple preventive procedures, you know, just to whole classrooms of children, just as they did at the very beginning of their profession. In some states, dental practice acts prevent them from doing as much. So it varies from state to state. But you know, that's one idea. And state lawmakers and governors are interested in this because, you know, they're seeing the price tag of this more expensive care, you know, especially for their Medicaid population, which is, you know, a large population, you know, large segment of America. In most states it is. So they want this less expensive preventive care. They want to cut down on these emergency room visits, you know, and kind of take the upstream approach to fighting oral disease and preventing disease. So the cost curve, you know, is they're trying to bend it, you know, toward prevention. And it certainly, there are some promising developments out there in that regard, you know.
Hmm. Well, it's fascinating stuff, and I appreciate your coming to discuss it with us. Mary Otto, the book is Teeth, the Story of Beauty, Inequality, and the Struggle for Oral Health in America. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's great to be with you. Thanks for the great conversation.